This is Norman B's Life Elsewhere, the show about art, media, and culture.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. They were born on the same dates, the same month, 12 years apart. Now, it could just be a coincidence that two of the most important cultural figures of the last 100 years share the same birthday. But we like to think it has to be a deliberate and delicious plan of the gods to make January the 8th the birthday of Elvis Presley and David Bowie. Well, every year at Life Elsewhere, we pay tribute to either both or one of these two legends. This year, we're going to focus in on the man who dared to wear makeup and flashy clothes while still only 18 years old, and he was a truck driver. Yeah, Elvis. Coming up, two favorite guests join the show to share their thoughts on the king. Now, by 1968, Elvis was still the king of rock and roll, but for many, he was a has-been. Rock music had moved beyond and transcended him. He spent his post-army years making movies and movie soundtracks of lessening quality with each passing one. In Return of the King, Elvis Presley's great comeback, music journalist Gillian Gar spotlights Presley's December 1968 comeback special that revitalized his career for a brief few years until he fell back into his old habits and relied on management that increasingly took Elvis for granted. Gillian Gar will join us later in the show. First, he's frequently referred to as a cult artist, he's a singer-songwriter, an all-round nice guy, and he gives terrific hugs. Ronnie Elliott is here to recall being 14 when he met and took photos of Elvis in rural Florida. Ronnie Elliott, thank you for joining us again at Life Elsewhere.
Good to be here, Norman.
And I mean that. You do give great
hugs. Oh, thank you. I don't believe anybody's ever told me that.
So listen, Ronnie. Elvis Presley, both you and I are total Elvis fans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's no bigger impact or influence on my life, I would
yeah.
say.
I would agree. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not a musician that like you are, but Elvis made a huge impact on my life. But in talking to you over a period of time, you have told me some stories. But one of the stories that has just stuck with me is that you met Elvis Presley. Not only did you meet him, but you have photographs and you have a collection of just unbelievable treasures. I want to talk about you meeting Elvis, and I want to talk about your just these amazing photographs that you have. But I also want to talk to you about Elvis, just Ronnie Elliott's take on Elvis. Let's start at the beginning. When did you first hear Elvis?
I suppose it was the end of 1955.
Yeah.
Elvis came to Tampa three times at that point. My mother went to one of those shows at the Armory here. And in fact, she worked with a young woman, Evelyn Gold, who was the president of the first Elvis Presley fan club.
Get out of here.
Not the first one in Tampa.
No, the first one.
Yeah.
Ever.
So yeah. Elvis stayed with her at least two of the three times that he was here.
Wow.
So I have a lot of stuff that Evelyn gave me back then, but I didn't see any of those shows.
Right. Yeah.
I miss him. But that would have been the beginning. So the first records, right about the time that he was, you know, going to sign with RCA
yeah.
and everything happened. So.
Yeah. So when Elvis started to make an impact and you're a young man and you're hearing his records, your first take?
Well, it just changed everything. And even the name.
Yes.
It's like, what is an Elvis Presley?
Right.
And it still fascinates me. I mean, those records cause the hair on my arm to stand up. But
yes.
So does the mention of the name Elvis
yes.
Presley.
Yes,
as
yes.
odd as it is after
yeah.
this amount of time.
So let's just jump forward just a little bit. You're how old when you meet him?
I was 14 years old.
Wow.
He was filming Follow That Dream in Crystal River, around Crystal River, Yankee Town,
yeah,
primarily.
Right. And how did you get to meet him?
Well, I put pieces together of stories that had run in the Tampa Tribune and the St. Petersburg Times and figured out that he had to be staying at this place, Port Paradise, in Crystal River. So I would get my mother or my mother's friends, anybody old enough to drive, I would get to take me up to Crystal River.
Yeah.
And the first morning that we went up, we got there before the sun came up, and driving through the parking lot, we see a Cadillac with Tennessee tags. And it's like, well, there's a hint.
Oh, my.
And by the time we parked, Elvis was strolling out of his little cottage and stopped and spent time with us, talked, signed things for us. And you know.
What? Tell me the first, just those first moments. Because this man was like a god, I guess. I mean, this bigger than life, larger than life person, and there he is right in front of you. Just give me a feeling of how that was.
Well, this might be the story that you were talking about. My friend Sylvie Simmons did an interview, a long interview with Tom Petty 3 or 4 years ago, and she called me all excited to say, Tom Petty describes Elvis physically exactly like you do. Tom Petty saw Elvis for the first time, barely knew anything about him when he was filming the same movie. And when he told her that he saw Elvis strolling up the sidewalk, he said there was an aura. He glowed, and he wasn't touching the ground. He floated.
Wow.
And she said, that's exactly as you described him. And I said, that's because that's exactly the way it was.
Wow.
And that is true.
And how was he? I get the feeling from the photographs, there seems to be almost, dare I say it, a kind of a comfortable intimacy. The way there you are talking to this man, and we've got photographs, and if you're Darius, can we put some up on our site?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
These photographs are just magnificent. There you are with this man. As you say, he's got this aura. But there seems to be this just normal kind of comfort.
It is as though if you're in his visual frame, you're his friend. You know, there he was. Wow. Too polite and too sweet to walk away. He wouldn't leave you. He would stand there and talk as long as you wanted to talk.
That is incredible.
Yeah.
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 Going back in time, and to that time, to being a 14-year-old young man in Florida, meeting Elvis Presley, did you have any inkling to the sort of the incredible fame that this man would had and would have?
Yeah, by that time,
he was,
I certainly knew. It was fairly obvious that he was the most famous human being alive at
right.
that time.
Yes. Yeah.
And now, if I had met him earlier, or if I had been around him earlier, I think it wouldn't have seemed possible. But by that time, it had been going on, you know, for that amount of time. Well, only 5 years.
Yes, yes.
It seems like forever.
Forever. And, yes. Yeah. You've got a big box of photographs here, and I'm going to ask you just to pick out one. And just I know this is radio, but we can do a little sort of visual for our audience, and they can look at it online.
Yeah.
But just pick out one for us, Ronnie.
Okay.
That one with you and Elvis, and just describe for us what we're seeing in this picture. Ronnie's picking out a picture right now from his big collection here.
Okay, well, here is this one has always appealed to me because it's me with my cousin, George, and Elvis with his cousin, Gene. And Elvis is signing things in my scrapbook. Well, no, let's see. My scrapbook is in my hand, so he's signing something else right there. But I believe in this picture he is standing on my little sliver of wood that I
Yes, I want
you.
To get to that. Yes, yes, yes.
So I've always liked the idea, though, of me and my cousin and Elvis and his cousin.
That's okay. We're going to have that up on the site. Ronnie Elliott's with Elvis and his cousin and your cousin. And let's talk about that sliver of wood.
Yes. Well, let's see. I must have been in the fourth grade, I think, and a kid at Roosevelt Elementary School asked me, do you have a piece of wood that Elvis stepped on? All the kids knew that Elvis was, you know, all I thought about. He asked, do you have a piece of wood that Elvis stepped on? I said, I don't understand I don't know what that means. And he said, my brother sent off to Jiffy Pop, the popcorn company. They sent him a piece of wood that Elvis stepped on.
Oh. And you just showed this piece to
yeah.
me. And it's a tiny piece of wood.
Yeah, just a little sliver.
Maybe we'll photograph that and put that up on the site.
Okay. Yeah.
It really is. It's a wonderful treasure to have. We are talking to Ronnie Elliott. He's a fabulous musician. He's been on the program before. Love talking to Ronnie. Ronnie met Elvis when he was 14 years old, not too far from his home in Tampa, Florida. We're going to talk more with Ronnie right after this.
We'd love to hear what you have to say. Write to this address, info@lifeelsewhere.com. co. That's C-O.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ronnie Elliott, a terrific musician and somebody that I've had on the program before because he's just a terrific raconteur. He met Elvis Presley when Ronnie was 14 years old. And the wonder is he took photographs. He took them himself. And they're terrific photographs, Ronnie. They really are.
Thank you.
Black and white photographs. And we've already talked about what a thrill it was for you. And Elvis almost looks like he was floating when he came towards you. And he just this glow. After you met Elvis, did you ever, as the years have gone by, did you ever think about what you could have asked him at the time? Did you ask him any questions at the time?
I did, and I don't remember a lot of things.
Yeah.
My grandmother, in fact, one afternoon that she went up, asked him, and it had better discussions that I remember. My grandmother began telling Elvis about how many fights I had been in school as a kid, taking up for Elvis.
Really?
And, which was obviously not comfortable for me.
Right.
I was shuffling my feet as a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
But Elvis said, oh, I could teach you something to take care of that. And I asked, karate? And he said, yeah. So he offered to teach me karate. I had no idea what karate was. I had read that Elvis
sure.
was studying karate. I mean, I knew the white suits and all of that. But
what a great story.
So it was really, you know, certainly I wasn't going to stand there and tell him that I'd been in fights defending him.
Now, we've established, it's very clear, I'm a fan, you're a fan. Time has gone on, and you followed his career up until his untimely death. So let's move on from the time that you met him for instance, later in the program, I'm going to be talking to Gillian Garth. She's a journalist who writes about music, and she has a book called Return of the King, Elvis Presley's Great Comeback. Now, as you know, and I know, this was the comeback special, as it's now known, and where Elvis is dressed in the black leather,
right.
And it's just powerful. It's a big, big moment in his career. Tell me your thoughts about that.
Well, I still had all of my memories from 1956,
right.
And so nothing had ever changed much for me,
but
for a lot of us, I suspect.
Right.
But I think the Beatles had turned things to a point so that the relevance of Elvis as somebody who changed the world was diminished, at least on a news basis.
Yes.
And the idea that here was this vital human being who clearly could change everything.
Right.
And, of course, without Elvis, there wouldn't have been any Beatles.
Right.
So for me, it just all made sense. It was less dramatic because, I hadn't seen much of him, but he was still Elvis as far as I was concerned.
So let's talk a little bit more about that and about his career, because from a lot of points of view, people did start to make fun of him and mock him when he was wearing the jumpsuits
right.
and the Las Vegas time. Your thoughts about that, Ronnie?
I don't really have any interest in even though I think he made some great records during that period, they don't hold much interest for me, other than the fact that it is Elvis.
Yes.
And he had those great musicians playing with him. I mean, James Burton was his guitar player at that point. So it was still Elvis Presley, but he was never at some point, Elvis became aware that he was Elvis. You know,
yes.
I guess if people tell you you're the center of the universe for long enough, you start to take it for granted.
Yes.
And that changed everything, too. I think Elvis was the first Elvis impersonator when you get
yes.
right down to it.
Yes, gosh, that is so important. Yes, yes. You know, there's been a lot of discussion, and I've thought about it, and I'm sure that you have over the years. You've sort of pondered on what would have happened if Elvis had managed to escape the clutches of Colonel Tom and, of course, the Memphis Mafia.
Yeah.
Your thoughts?
It is a double-edged sword because when might he have left, you know? We wouldn't have had Elvis. You and I probably never would have heard the name.
Right.
If Colonel Parker hadn't done what he did, his magic. And at a certain point, certainly by the time he was going into the army, he could have done without him and the world would have probably been a better place.
Yes.
But, it's hard to say. And as far as all the hanger-ons and all of the Memphis guys, he was an insecure person. And I remember an interview from 1956 where he said, I'm lonely in a crowd.
Right.
And I never forgot that, you know.
Yes.
The idea that in 1956, I was a nine-year-old boy reading that, and it hit me with such impact that I just never forgot it.
Right.
So I think that's what the old friends and then the guys that he met in Germany and the ones who just became the Memphis Mafia, I think that's what that was about.
Just imagining, and I know this is a difficult thing to do, Ronnie, and it maybe it's, but let's try it anyway. Just imagining if he had have escaped that the clutches of what he was in, he got out of that situation and did some traveling on his own or met up with other musicians that were, for instance, I mean, he met the Beatles, but perhaps maybe he'd sort of thought about playing with some of the more contemporary people at the time. Any thoughts about where Elvis could have gone musically?
Well, musically and movie-wise.
Yes.
You know, you watch some of the movies that aren't particularly good. I saw half an hour of Wild in the Country the other day, and it's not a particularly good movie, but Elvis is great at it every now and then. For 5 minutes at a time, he's a real actor.
Right.
And not that I know anything about that, but I suspect that he could have been one of the most important musicians rolling right on through with a very long career and an important actor too.
Mm.
That's what I think I see.
When he died, and this is a subject, this is a part that I just find so, it's so painful talking about in a lot of respects, because you always think about what he had going for him.
Mm-hmm.
And his demise was really, really not very nice, was it?
No, and there are two things that always come to mind for me. One, the death of his mom seemed to have just changed everything. And that was just before he left to go to Germany, which is apparently when he began experimenting with drugs, which were legal and, you know, nobody thought very much about it. But the incredibly sweet person that I described does not match some of the stories that you hear about the, you know, towards the end.
Right.
And I don't know that you can untangle the death of his mother from his drug abuse and obsession with her death itself.
You know, this is sort of an ironic thing. The day that I arrived in America in 1977 was the day that Elvis died.
Wow.
Yeah. And what was really curious for me, I was in America to get away from sort of some really unpleasantly things that had happened to me in London, being my mother had died, right?
Yeah.
So it was kind of a real sort of double whammy, you know?
Yeah.
And there we were, 1977, and Elvis dies. Talk to me just your take on, if you like, the day that he died.
Well, there are a couple of things. The first personal part of it is that I just couldn't believe that Elvis had died at all. That seemed impossible to me. Different from a relative.
Yes, you know, yes.
Elvis was too big a part of the world. And one of the other things is all of those quotes showed up in all the publications and, you know, through UPI and AP. And the John Lennon quote when they said, what do you think about Elvis dying? And he quipped, Elvis died the day he went into the army.
Yes.
And I realized, well, that's true as well in a lot of ways.
Yes. Yeah. You know, one curious thing, and it's just sort of a side note here, he never visited the UK.
No.
He went to Paris.
Yeah.
There's a book of photographs of him having a great time in Paris.
The dancing girls.
The dancing girls. But he never went to London, never went to the UK.
Yeah.
Just curious that. Yeah. Ronnie, you're always just a fabulous guest to talk to. As a big fan of Elvis, I'm going to put you right on the spot now, and I hope you don't mind.
Mm.
But you've listened to Elvis's music since you were a lad. And I know you, like me, you still listen to this day. Choose for me one record of Elvis's that we can play to take us out of this interview.
Well, it's going to change all the time, but right at the moment, My Baby Left Me.
Oh, my God, that is such a good one. Oh, great. That beginning to that record always just like...
Yeah.
It's breathtaking.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Ronnie Elliott, you are just a treasure.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I've got to tell everybody, if you've never heard Ronnie sing and play, let's get you back on and just do a little singing and song session for us.
Let's do that.
Yeah. Ronnie Elliott, everybody, talking about Elvis. Wish you all the well. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
baby left me. My baby even left me, never said a word. Lord, I stand at my window, wring my hands and cry. I hate to lose that woman, hate to say goodbye. You know she left me, yes, she left me. My baby even left me, never said a word. Red blues, boy.
Still to come in the show, author Gillian Gaar talks to me about Elvis and Return of the King, Elvis Presley's great comeback.
You are listening to Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
Music journalist Gillian Gaar is here to talk about her book, Return of the King, Elvis Presley's great comeback. Gillian, welcome back to Life Elsewhere.
Well, it's great to be back.
So you've got a book which I have thoroughly enjoyed. It's titled Return of the King. And of course, we're talking about Elvis Presley's great comeback. It also happens to be tying in with a date that I always remember, and every year we try to do something. We're just a few days later this year of Elvis Presley's birthday on January the 8th. But there's a whole bunch of other things that happen around this time of the year. Can you fill us in?
Yeah, well, it's a period the book covers as well, too. We start in December 68, which just over 50 years ago now, was when Elvis's comeback special aired. It was just called Elvis, but it's since come to be known as the comeback special, where he revived himself after being lost in Hollywood for all those dreary years. And then the next month, January and February 69, 50 years ago, he recorded in Memphis for the first time since his Sun Records days at Chip Moman's American Sound Studios, which was enjoying a great run of hits that they were recording there at the time. And Elvis joined in and got some hits himself, things like In the Ghetto and Suspicious Minds and Kentucky Rain. And then he topped it off by in the summer in August, or actually I think the opening night was probably July 31st, he returned to live performance in Las Vegas.
Such a lot of great memories and such an important time for Elvis and for Elvis fans. It's really wonderful to sort of look back at this period. And I think it's also really wonderful to look at your book, The Return of the King, Elvis Presley's Great Comeback. Let's just delve into this a little bit, Gillian. The sort of inspiration for writing this book obviously was the comeback, the special, Elvis. But go into it further for me. What really sort of made you sort of go, okay, I can get a book out of this?
Well, actually, to sort of bring a couple threads together, kind of the inspiration came when I was reading another book the publisher put out. It's Jawbone Press, based in England. And one of the editors there had done a book on David Bowie, who also shares a birthday with Elvis. So see, this all kind of relates. He'd done a book called Bowie in Berlin, obviously about the so-called Berlin trilogy of albums that Bowie put out. And as I read it, I thought, gee, that's a great idea to, you know, do a book that just focuses on an element of an artist's career instead of another full-length biography. And I thought this comeback period of Elvis's would be a good period to look at because, you know, actually until kind of recently, they really didn't, I don't think it was all really tied together in the way I did. It was sort of, you know, overlooked, I think. A lot of books that focused on certain periods in his life, they'd probably focus on the early years, the 50s years, which of course are very exciting, or the 70s and, you know, all the touring and the jumpsuit era, the superhero, Elvis in the superhero
yes.
era.
Yeah, yeah.
But this was the transitional period, you know, something that brought you from the one side to the other. And it all kind of, you know, flowed from the same thing. The excess of the comeback special really led to his doing those recordings in Memphis. And the success of that just sort of generated his desire to return to live performance again.
Yes.
So it all kind of snowballed.
Yes.
And, you know, it was a pivotal point. Things could have gone differently for him at that point, which they ultimately didn't. But I think that gives a greater poignancy in looking back at it.
You know, the fact that you give us all that information, and I'm just as you're saying all that, I'm thinking to myself, I remember seeing it when it was aired, and I remember thinking to myself, my goodness, this is really monumental, because Elvis, he looked different. He sounded different. His energy was up. The whole thing was a sort of a revitalized Elvis. And one of the things you talk about in your book, and I think it's really important, is the fact that everybody was aware of the fact that the way he looked, the look, the leather was so important. You even talk about in your book how people in England abandoned their denim jeans and denim jackets, and everybody was hunting down leather all the time. Just talk about that a little more for us.
Well, I don't know that he ever looked better. I mean, I think that might have been his peak of attractiveness in that special. And certainly the leather outfit was very iconic. And what I didn't realize until I talked to the costume designer, Bill Ballou, is if you watch in the special, there's another segment, the so-called Guitar Man sequence, where it's sort of illustrating his rise to fame in a sort of more cinematic way. You know, he starts out as this traveling itinerant guitar man, then becomes more and more successful through this little series of set pieces. And his basic getup, when he's in that early part of the itinerant traveler, he's wearing, you know, denims. He's wearing this blue shirt with the solid square pockets and blue jeans, and that's his outfit. And Bill Ballou said the leather outfit was based on that. When you look at it, you can see it. It's the same design, you know, the same blocky, heavy jacket with those pockets, those chest pockets. And, you know, you look at what he wears in that sequence, then you look at the leather outfit, you say, oh, yeah, that's where it came from. Really finely honed. You know, you look at his face and his nose, it's all just very sharp.
Yes.
You know, sort of a side note, one thing I always thought was interesting, I think you saw this a lot in Peter Guralnick's wonderful biographies of Elvis.
Yes.
What impressed me was how many times in the book men would say that they thought Elvis was attractive. And not because they were, you know, really attracted to him, but they would be in his presence and they think, man, that's a good-looking guy.
Can we talk about that for a moment? Because I think this is something about Elvis that really needs to be looked into a little bit more. Because there are people that have said he has a sort of a Greek godlike demeanor. And there's been people that have done sort of analysis of his face with statues, Greek statues. There is this thing, it's not homoerotic, or is it? Let me ask you as a writer, because you've been doing this for a long time, is there sort of homoeroticism in this, in the sort of love of Elvis and the way he looked?
You know, maybe at a very basic level. I mean, it gets tricky here because people think you try and read that into everything. And I mean, you think of the way a woman generally has no problem in saying she thinks another woman is beautiful,
right.
And no one's going to think, oh, she must be attracted to that woman sexually. No, she just has the freedom to say that. And, you know, maybe she is attracted sexually, but maybe she isn't. And people don't think about that. But men, it seems, are held to a different standard, and they're a little more nervous about saying that, which was why it was striking for me to read so many men saying that, because they were just evidently taken aback by the sort of charisma that they said he seemed to exude when you were in the room with him, and not when he was, you know, all necessarily dressed up and ready to go out and perform, but just being himself.
Yes. We're talking to Gillian Gaar. Her book is called Return of the King, Elvis Presley's Great Comeback. It's all about the what is now known as the Comeback Special, and originally it was just titled Elvis. I think everybody has to have seen shots from it if they haven't actually seen the special. And it was, how many years ago was it now?
Well, they shot it in June 1968, and then it aired in December.
Right.
You know what's funny though, kind of interesting, last summer, this would be summer 2018, they took an extended version of the special, because the special just was a one-hour show on TV, and they've expanded it into, I don't know, about a 90-minute cut, and they played it in movie theaters across America on different dates. And I went to the one they had here in Seattle, and I ran into a friend of mine there, a woman who's an Elvis fan, and I was surprised that she'd never seen it. I mean, she'd seen parts of it, she said, bits on television. So I think maybe that's how a lot of people have seen it. But even her as an Elvis fan had not seen the complete version.
That's interesting, Julian. That
really
is. Yeah.
Yeah.
When it was aired, was it ABC that aired it? It was, wasn't it?
It was NBC.
Oh, it was NBC, excuse me.
Yeah.
Were they aware at the time? Have you had any feedback on this about how important it was, how special the special was?
Well, Steve Binder, who directed the special, he said when he met with Elvis, and he was very honest with Elvis, and Elvis asked him, you know, well, what do you think of the state of my career? And Bender said, you know, it's, I think he even said it's in the toilet, you know, you're washed up.
Yeah.
And that he did say, he stressed the importance of it to Elvis, the special. He said, you know, it could be a make or break moment. And he said, he admitted it was a gamble. He said, if you're on television, you know, you're exposed to this audience of millions. And if you're a hit or if you're a flop, you're going to know right away. You know, the next day it'll either be all kinds of raves or else your career will be done. So he knew he had a lot riding on it, Elvis did, but I think by that point he figured he had nothing to lose. And he had seen, I think he was probably fairly confident because when he saw the first edit, Bender says that, you know, they brought in their friends and everyone's watching, and they got through the first screening, and he said no one said anything. And Bender said, that's the worst feeling you can have as a director. But then Elvis sent everybody away, and he wanted to see it again. So he and Bender just sat there and watched it a second time, I think maybe even a third. And Elvis was just overwhelmed by it. He knew he'd done good work, and he was very pleased. So I can't help but think there was probably some kind of gleeful anticipation for him as the air date came closer. You know, what's it going to be? Well, he knew he'd done good work. Whereas with his films, I mean, Elvis wasn't stupid. He knew a lot of those films were bad. I mean, sometimes they were making him physically ill.
Yes.
You look how right before that, the films that he made that were coming out before the special aired, you know, he's looking kind of pudgy because he's bored and overeating. And he's just on this treadmill of making one movie after another. And you know, you can see he's losing interest. Whereas you said it yourself, the energy in the special, obviously this was something he liked to do. I think that's what must have been really frustrating for him. He had this talent, but yet if he wasn't given a proper vehicle for it, like being stuck in a lousy movie like Double Trouble, that's one where he sings Old MacDonald.
Yes. yes.
When he's given good material, he could still rise to the challenge.
There's so much to talk about if we go off on a little tangent talking about his movies. And you do talk about one movie in particular in the book, and that's Charo. I want to get into that and some other movies around that time. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back, talk to Gillian Gaar about Elvis, the comeback special, Return of the King, and Charo right after this.
You are listening to the best show on radio about art, media, and culture. Life Elsewhere with Norman B.
Boy, my boy. Woo! It's been a long time, Jack, I'm telling you.
It's been a while.
A while.
About 15 minutes.
About 15 minutes, my
friend. Are we on TV?
No, we're on a train heading for Tulsa.
Okay. Man. Good night.
Quick show.
Well, since my baby left me, I found a new place to dwell. But it's down at the end of a lonely street at Heartbreak Hotel.
My guest is Gillian Gaar. She has a book called Return of the King, Elvis Presley's Great Comeback. This features the comeback special, it is now called. NBC produced it. It was known at the time when it first came out as just Elvis, and it really is. If you haven't seen it, it's just absolutely magnificent. It's Elvis in just the finest form ever for anybody watching Elvis live outside of those first black and white shots that you've seen from way back when. We talked about a movie called Charo, and this was a movie, this was one of what I consider to be three movies, well actually four movies, and I'm going to list them for you. Elvis considered to be serious movies. Love Me Tender, yes. And he only sings at the end of it. The end, he's superimposed. It's the death scene, and he's so sad. It's horrible, but...
Oh,
it's,
yeah, his death is sad. And then, what I had read was that... So he dies, and then it shows them walking away from the cemetery after he's been buried, and the fans are upset. So yeah, they superimposed his ghostly image
over the top,
singing "Love Me Tender" again, which it sung earlier in the movie to his mother.
That's right.
Enough.
That's right. So there was that movie. Then there were two other movies that were considered to be serious movies. There's Wild in the Country and Flaming Star. I think Flaming Star came first, didn't it?
Yeah, I think you're right.
And then, of course, there was Charo, which was considered to be a serious movie, or Elvis considered to be a serious movie. And there was, I think, one song in that. And in your book, you talk about how to make him look sort of rough, like a kind of villainous, reformed villainous cowboy. They had him grow a beard, but his beard didn't grow in properly. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, the rest of his gang, the Mafia, the Memphis Mafia, were also growing beards. You know, they have to follow the leader. But yeah, he had a little trouble with that, so they had to sort of fill it in. You know, that was his spaghetti western, really.
Yes.
And the only song played was the title song. They actually were going to put one in the movie, but thankfully they did not.
With eyes that hide the man within, see behind the eyes of other men. You've lived and died and come to life again, and now you're standing alone at the crossroads of your mind. You've left your yesterdays behind, but which road leads you to tomorrow?
You know, you see this with a lot of the films in the later part of Elvis's career, in that they're not bad, but they're not that good.
Yeah.
And you have a feeling that with a script like Charo, if they'd done a couple rewrites, you know, and made it stronger, because, you know, it's an interesting storyline. And as you say, reformed gunslinger, I guess,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he gets drawn back in with the old gang, and is he going to help them, for, you know, for one more score, that kind of thing. And, you know, that's a decent enough storyline, and it just could have been a better or stronger movie, but, yeah, it just was not. It kind of drags at times,
yes,
I think.
Yes. Well, this all kind of ties in with the comeback special, because... So here he is on stage with the TV cameras on him and for the comeback special. And he just looks magnificent. But one of the, I think, is the most important things about the comeback special is he looks happy, and he looks happy with the audience. The audience looks happy back, and so do the musicians. Talk to me about the relationship with the musicians on that show.
Well, Steve Binder, the director, had said, and, you know, this is interesting, he said, if Elvis hadn't wanted to stay in the studio overnight when we were shooting at Burbank, we probably would not have got those live segments, because Elvis didn't want to commute all the way back to Beverly Hills to Burbank every day. So when they moved production to the studios in Burbank, he asked if, you know, they could set up the dressing room so he could stay there, and of course they could. And Binder noticed that after the day was done, he would be hanging out in his dressing room with his guys, and just playing the guitar, and some of the others were musicians. Charlie Hodge could play guitar, and they'd just be singing and just relaxing and having fun. And that's where Binder got the idea for him to do they call it the sit-down sequence, because he's sitting down in most of it. He wanted to have an improv segment like that, where it wasn't, you know, firmly worked out, exactly worked out what they were going to do, because there were two performance segments. There's one where he's standing up in that sort of boxing ring type setup, and there are musicians kind of off screen, and, you know, they do some sort of orchestral arrangements because they have a horn section, stuff like that, and the audience is around. But then Binder wanted to do the improvisational one, where it wouldn't have a set list. And he thought about bringing in the musicians that Elvis had played with in the 50s. And now Bill Black had died, the bass player.
Right.
But Scotty Moore was still alive, as was DJ Fontana, who was a drummer. So they brought them in. And actually, I interviewed Binder last year about this, and he said when Scotty and DJ arrived and were all hanging out with Elvis, he said it was for him, Bender watching, he said it was like watching people who had known each other really well and hadn't seen each other for a while, and then you get back together and you sort of pick up where you left off. He thought they just sort of fell in back together. And they worked that with Scotty on his guitar, and DJ, they wondered about some of the setup, and DJ suggested playing on the guitar case or whatever, or using brushes. You know, he's not using a drum.
Right.
He's providing percussion.
Yes.
And Charlie Hodge is there. He's on guitar. And there was another fellow who was also hitting on a guitar case, because Elvis was very nervous about these shows. But you mentioned interacting with the audience, and a woman I interviewed who attended the shows, she'd moved to L.A. just to be close to Elvis. She was an Elvis fan. And she would go up to the house where he stayed at when he was in L.A. And he was one of those who would, you know, he'd often come out to the gate and talk to the fans there. He certainly didn't keep him at arm's length. And as the special grew closer, he had tickets, of course, and he gave them to the girls that were waiting at the gate all the time. So she went to all the shows, all four shows. But she said how, you know, there were those of that were in the group that were fans that had been given tickets, and they were sitting there. And so a lot of those people Elvis knew, and when he's performing, he would deliberately make eye contact with them because he knew them, which was something I hadn't realized until talking to Sandy.
Wow, that's interesting.
That he'd see someone, and then, like, I think when he drops on his knees in front of someone, that's because he knew her.
Ah.
And he was just doing all these little things because they were his friends.
Wow.
Not every time, but, you know, some of them were
his
friends.
I'm just wondering, when you spoke to Bender, did you ask him if there were any outtakes?
Not per se. I mean, well, I guess yes and no. You know, everything's available now, though. I think maybe as far as, well, wait a minute, let me back up and start again. So they just released a new set that puts everything together, but you can still get them in two different boxes. So, yeah, I guess you could consider them outtakes because they don't use everything in that show. But here you get to see the whole show.
Yes.
And it's not like they stopped and went back and recorded something again if it didn't come out right. It was just like shooting a performance.
It comes
out how it comes out. And then with the stand-up shows, they basically did the same thing, although there, a couple of times, they did have him repeat something because they didn't cue the tape up right, or he had to do a certain movement and it didn't happen right. But, yeah, you can watch them all in their entirety, and that's really fascinating because you get all the between-songs chat, especially in the stand-up shows, which was, you know, more he'd finish and then they'd all applaud, whereas the sit-down, that's sort of more continuous. But, you know, he does all these funny little things in between, like he started singing part of MacArthur Park.
Yes.
And it also has the complete final show program, and then it has all the outtakes from the production numbers, because there was a gospel sequence, and there was that longer, there was the opening sequence and the closing sequence where he does If I Can Dream, and then the longer Guitar Man sequence I mentioned where it just shows him rising to fame.
Yes.
And that's a pretty good box.
You know, I have the original album, the soundtrack, I guess that's what you call it, for the show.
Yeah.
And I, and this is just a true story, Jillian, I put that on the other day to listen to it as I'm going through, because I've read your book a number of times, and I'm going through it just to make some notes for talking to you today. So I had the soundtrack on as I'm reading your book. I highly encourage everybody else to do that, because it's just, it works together very, very well. One thing that I got to ask you about is the surprises in writing this, because you've done your research, you talked to Bender, you talked to a lot of people that were in the audience. Anything that just like stuck out for you as a big surprise?
Well, let's see. As far as a big surprise, let me see. In that coming together, I mean, there were some things that I wanted to have clarified, like with in talking to Bender, how before Elvis went out to do that very first show, how nervous he was and that he didn't want to go. That he told Bender, I can't do it. And this is, you know, after the audience is in place and everything. I mean, it's literally right before showtime. and to have Bender say how he had to, you know, persuade him that, no, you've got to go out, and just kind of forcing him. Basically, he said, you know, if nothing else, you have to go out there and sit down, and if all you want to do is say goodnight and then come back into the room, fine, but you've got to go out there.
Mm.
So some of the surprises came I think perhaps in some of the later years, where after, say, 1970, and I talked to some of the musicians that work with him in the studio, and you get the sense of things they say that, you know, Elvis knew he was trapped but didn't know how to change things.
Right.
Like Ronnie Tutt, the drummer, who actually he played with him on stage, too, said how at one session Elvis would bring him upstairs and he played him some current records. And was saying to him, why don't my records sound like that? Because he liked the, you know, sort of brightness and vibrancy.
Yeah.
And other things, I suppose. And, oh, was it Norbert Putman? Yeah, Norbert told me this great story. He also worked with George Harrison. And he talked about going over to England and working with George on his stuff and George's label. He worked with Splinter that was on this label that George had.
Yeah.
And Norbert had all these questions about the Beatles, and finally George said, well, look, I'll answer all your questions about the Beatles if you'll answer all my questions about Elvis.
Ah.
And just to find out what a big fan George Harrison was, and talking about how nervous he was when he met him, not only in the 60s when the Beatles were together, but he saw, I think it was one of the Madison Square Garden shows. And that, you know, afterwards, meeting Elvis, he said he just felt like a gibbering fan.
Ah.
And but he encouraged Norbert. He said, you know, you should bring Elvis over here to England, because after they were working, they were taking a break, and they went into town. This is when George is living at Henley-on-Thames, and they went into the local pub. And Norbert was amazed how they could just go in this pub, and everyone looks up, sees it's George Harrison, and they just go back to their beers.
Yeah.
So he and George sat there and, you know, had their evening. And then when they left, George said, see, you know, you should bring Elvis here. People aren't going to make a fuss. This is England. This is different.
Yes.
And Norbert said he had this vision of, wow, what a wonderful thing it would be to get Elvis out of his shell and come here to do this. But he knew it was never going to happen.
Isn't that the saddest thing? I think we all who are fans of Elvis have always had this wonder about what would have happened if Elvis had escaped the clutches of Colonel Tom, if he could have got out of that environment that he was in, if he could have gone to England, as you say, what... He'd probably still be alive making incredible music. And I'm most often thinking about that. Julian, in your book, you cover a lot of areas. You talk about a lot of things. In doing the interviews with Bender and some of the people that were at the show, did you get the feeling that everybody that was involved, that there was a sort of a magnetism happening at the time? Did that come across on the set?
Yeah, it definitely did. I think, you know, at first the team, you know, they want to do a good show. They're working together. And I think as it went on, people became more aware that they were getting involved in something special. Here's something that sort of addresses that and also the bit about the surprises. When they were, before they'd gone to Burbank, and they were still just doing rehearsals, not at Burbank yet. They were at the Bender's offices, and it was at the time that Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And, you know, he was shot and just after midnight on June 5th, that would be. And then he died the next day. And so I guess it probably was at the time when he was shot, because that was such a big deal, you know, practically live on television. His speech was, certainly. And then, you know, I still remember my mother had watched this. I was in bed, but, you know, she'd been watching, and she fell asleep, and then she woke up and there was all this chaos on the screen. We've seen those images. And so, like a lot of people, they were watching it too, Elvis and Bender and the film crew or the production crew. And so, yeah, you know, of course, it's like this major blow. This is just a few months after Martin Luther King's been killed. And one of the writers, Chris Beard, said this just seemed to unloosen something in Elvis, and he just, he had a guitar, and I guess he was just sort of picking and telling stories and talking about his life and just giving him all this stuff without it being an interview. You know, it was this cathartic moment for him watching this. It just sprung out all this stuff, and he began going into all these stories about, you know, being poor, because actually, I mean, among stars, he was probably, you know, he came from incredible poverty.
Yes.
Which people don't realize. I mean, even the Beatles, even someone like Ringo, you know, they had a house with electricity.
Right.
I
yes.
think.
Yes.
Or, you know, a flat, council flat, whatever. And
yes.
But yeah, Elvis didn't have that at all. You know, he lived in a house without running water
yeah.
when he was born, and there was an outhouse in the back. So yes, just all his struggles, and Chris Beard was saying just how, you know, awestruck they were at taking all this in. But in listening to that, they were thinking, yes, this is what we want to have in the story. You know, this is the real Elvis, or this is certainly another side of Elvis that people haven't seen. And I guess in the context of all those things, you know, Binder said he felt very much that their show, I guess you could say it was, you know, it showed the progressive side in America in a way, because he said, you know, he realized that they had a Puerto Rican choreographer, they had a black choreographer, they had people of different religions, everyone coming together. You know, the show was like a melting pot.
Yes.
That's the word I'm looking for. I think probably in that night when Elvis bared his soul, I think perhaps that's where we get the genesis of the song, If I Can Dream, which he did at the end.
Right.
Because Colonel Parker just wanted Elvis to do some kind of anodyne hit like I Believe or something.
Mm.
And after getting to know Elvis on this level, Binder thought, no, we're not going to do something corny or schmaltzy like that. So he gave the songwriters, and it was mostly, oh no, not Earl Brown, the other fellow, who wrote it. He said, you know, write something that encapsulates what we know Elvis to be. And that's how you got If I Can Dream, which, you know, it's this plea for brotherhood, but in a sort of general way that's not going to offend too many people, because Elvis really didn't make what you'd consider political statements. So it was broader, but you get the meaning due to the intensity of his performance. It's quite remarkable.
He was in such fine voice in that special. His voice was just so strong and powerful and just sweet when it wanted to be. I have to ask you, and this is probably going to be the sort of roundup to the interview, Julian, but I've got to ask you this question, even though I'm really hesitating in some respects. But because we know the history, because we know of how we understand how Elvis died, is there any reports on the special? Was there any information that you have that he was drinking or was taking drugs during that period?
Well, Elvis was never really a drinker. I know when he was younger, I don't think he even liked his friends around him to drink alcohol.
Right. Yes.
But, yeah, so that was never really a thing for him at any time of his life. I would say at the time of the special, you know, he wasn't using things as much. Certainly when he was working at the movies, he was using, it's known now he was using prescription drugs. A lot of times it would be a kind of thing where work-related reasons, diet pills, you know, to try and keep his weight down.
Right.
That was how things would be done. You know, the studios would just hand you this stuff. Oh, yeah, take this. This will help slim you down. But then, of course, that speeds, and then they have to give you something to help you sleep.
Right.
So, you know, that's where this cycle starts. But I would think that during this period, he'd cut back, as opposed to, say, earlier, where I write about he was making the film Clam Bake, and before shooting started, and they were in L.A., and he got up in the night and went into the bathroom, and he tripped over a cord for a heater or something, and he fell and hit his head. He wasn't seriously hurt, but it did put production off for a bit. And some people have suggested, well, perhaps, you know, he was on his downers then and was a little woozy, and that's also partly why he fell, which would make more sense because he was making a movie that, you know, another one not very good.
Right.
and he was bored. And during those periods when he got bored, I mean, you can even just see physically, you can see how he gets kind of pudgier.
Yes.
Because
yes.
he's just not as interested.
And that's the sadness of the Elvis Presley story, isn't it?
Yeah, that he never was able to stand up and take the reins for himself. He couldn't break away from the colonel to say, you know, I want things done this way. Actually, in the comeback, or this whole comeback period, you see that somewhat. When Binder knew how, what's the right word? Well, just how strong Binder was, how determined he was in his own views, the colonel didn't want to work with him. But the more Elvis knew him, he liked him and said, no, we're going to go with this. And the first season, when Elvis was in Vegas, you know, he pretty much set up that band himself and brought it together. But then, yeah, he just didn't oversee the business things as much. after that, the live performances got to be the same kind of grind as the movies were.
Yes, yes. Oh, gosh, yes. Do we have any knowledge what the Colonel thought of the comeback special?
You know, after it aired, I'm not sure. I don't know if he ever said anything publicly. I know Binder never got to talk to Elvis again, and he thought that was partly the Colonel's doing.
Ah.
That, you know, he was persona non grata.
Wow.
That he actually saw a couple of Elvis's shows in Vegas. And when he tried to talk to him afterwards, you know, get word to him backstage, oh, we can't reach him. And that the last time he saw and talked to Elvis, Elvis had given him a phone number and said, oh, this is, you know, a private line. You can reach me that way. And he never got through.
The book is a great read. It's called Return of the King, Elvis Presley's Great Comeback. It centers on Elvis's comeback special, as it is now known. If you've never seen it, you've got to pick it up and do as I did. Watch it, get the LP, and read Jillian's book at the same time. Jillian has been Jillian Garr has been our guest. Got to ask you this before I let you go. You're always working on something. What's coming up that we need to know about?
Well, actually, I don't have anything right now.
Okay. Well, have a rest. Take some time off. Okay?
Yeah,
all right. Okay. Happy New Year to you. Thank you for joining us at Life Elsewhere. We've been talking to Jillian Garr. Jillian, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Shining on everyone, tell me why. Oh, why? Oh, why won't that sun appear? We're lost in a cloud with too much rain. We're trapped in a world that's troubled with pain. But it lost question. Still I am sure that the answer is gonna come somehow. Out there in the dark, there's a beckoning candle. Oh yeah, and while I can think, while I can walk, while I can stand, while I can talk, while I can dream,
a big thank you to my guests and a very big thank you to you for listening. To hear this show again, you have many options: NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Mixcloud, and our affiliate stations. The details are all up at lifeelsewhere.co. Till next time, be well, be good, and always be nice.
Thank you. Good night.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Vann, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O. Life Elsewhere is produced at the studios of WMNF Tampa.